will soon craft a new farm bill that will give billions of dollars to the largest, most profitable farms in the nation. This leads us to ask, what will we get for our billions of farm bill bucks?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 755th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Perryopolis who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with our own Miss Idaho, Nikki James, on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Folks, it's coming. The new farm bill is on its way. And given that we are going into a presidential election year and that our federal government is many trillions of dollars in debt, the crafting of this new farm bill is shaping up to be a monumental tug of war over our money. You see, with a new farm bill in hand, the federal government will take about $100 billion of our money and give it to its friends, many of whom just happen to be among the nation's largest and most successful farmers and landholders. As taxpayers rendered bankrupt beyond belief by a government that promises to give everybody everything for nothing and has done just that, you and I just have to ask, what will we get for our billions of farm bill bucks? To help us find some answers today, we turn first to Bruce Badcock, who is the professor of economics, Iowa State University. Bruce, good morning. Welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, well, great to have you aboard. You're a professor of economics. What's your specialty?
Agricultural economics and agricultural policy. Those two go hand in hand.
Good. And you sit in the Cargill Endowed Chair of Energy Economics. What's that?
That's Cargill, a big agribusiness.
They're the biggest, aren't they? Pretty much the biggest.
Privately held, and yeah. What they wanted to do, they gave endowed a professorship at Iowa State to look into the impacts of biofuels on agricultural markets, on food markets, and so you can see how that interplays with agricultural economics and agricultural policy. So that's my position right now.
Fair enough. And you also are the co-author of a paper entitled The Revenue Insurance Boondoggle, a Taxpayer-Paid Windfall for Industry, that was funded, I believe, by the Environmental Working Group?
They commissioned a study because they didn't understand what the crop insurance and what revenue insurance was, and so they commissioned a study, and then when they read my study, they named it the boondoggle. So that wasn't my choice, but it is somewhat of a boondoggle, I guess.
And both of these are very much part of the past and probably the future farm bills as well, correct?
That's right. The proposals for the new farm bill are really tied into new insurance kinds of plans for farmers that already have insurance, and that's what I was pointing out to in this report.
Fair enough. Also with us today, we have Beth Hoffman, who is the managing editor of Food Plus Tech Connect. Beth, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you aboard. Beth, you have to tell us about Food and Tech Connect.
Well, Food Tech Connect is a media company that provides news on information and technology for those working in the food industry. So our idea is to connect people and people who are farming, chefs, data geeks, developers, bring all these people together to drive innovation in the food chain.
And we certainly need some of that. Well, I first became aware of your work, Beth, when I ran into something called the Farm Bill Hackathon.
Yeah, we just held the Farm Bill Hackathon December 3rd, it was. Should I tell you about it now?
Yeah, please do. What is the Farm Bill Hackathon?
Yeah, so for many different reasons, we decided to bring together people. It was around something called the International Open Data Hackathon. So it's an international day.
Well, let's start with the hackathon itself.
Yeah, exactly. I think before I had been involved in this, I would think hacking, you know, that's something bad that happens to your bank account or your medical records, and it's something that you don't want to happen. But hacking is actually a term used in the tech community to mean that you take existing software and you improve it to help solve problems and find better solutions than what exists. So the concept of the International Open Data Hackathon is to take data that exists that is open source, so data that's coming from government entities, from different kinds of reports.
Right. For example, the things that Bruce Babcock just did. So you can take some of that information and then work with it.
Exactly. And we worked with the Environmental Working Group, has a lot of data that they've collected, amassed on their website. It's all accessible. So you take that sort of information and then create something out of it that's usable. So designers and developers often make apps for smartphones, or in this case, we tried to create visuals around the Farm Bill. So the whole idea was, you know, it's a very, very hard piece of legislation to understand. How can we kind of present the data in a way that the media and others could use to describe what's going on?
So, yeah, the Farm Bill is probably one of those, you know, million-page pieces of legislation that nobody reads.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, Marion Nestle has also been writing recently about how it's just, even if you are reading it, it's very difficult to follow because it refers to other passages that were done in other years. You know, it's a big historical document in many ways that has built upon, you know, successive years of writing it. So we tried to look at some specific projects, you know, some specific things that were in there or that people hoped would be in there, and to create visuals around that.
And so people can actually go someplace and look and see graphics then of what is in the Farm Bill and thus perhaps be able to understand it a little bit, whereas otherwise he would not be able to understand it at all.
This was the idea, and this is we've created. There were about five graphics that were created that day. A few different tools that are being processed into apps. That takes a little bit longer, but yes, you could see everything on our website, which is Food Tech Connect. And it's also, you know, all of these things again are Creative Commons licensing. Anybody can grab them and use them on their website to help describe these things.
Well, good. So here we have two people who have really taken a good look at the Farm Bill and perhaps can help us out here. Before we go to our first break, I'd like to ask each one of them what we will get for our billions of Farm Bill bucks. Bruce Babcock, as a professor of economics, what do you think we're going to get for all those billions of bucks?
Well, the most expensive item of the Farm Bill is actually the SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Food Stamp program.
Food stamps, right.
Yep. And so what we get for our bucks out of that part of the program is actually lots of food assistance for millions of Americans. And that part of the Farm Bill has widespread support pretty much across the political spectrum and across the country. So, you know, that is a big part of the Farm Bill.
So we take that chunk of it and set it aside because nobody's going to argue about that or even discuss it. That's that, and that's the way of it, and we'll move on to the rest of the Farm Bill, which is about, what, a third?
Or less than a third, yeah. And so what most people think of the Farm Bill, they think of the big subsidies that are going to big agricultural farms. And so what taxpayers are getting out of those subsidies is almost nothing. that the if you look back at studies that have looked at what would agriculture look like had those subsidies never come into being, you basically conclude that agriculture today would look almost identical to what it looks like now if we had never had the subsidies. And so if you ask the question, well, what are taxpayers getting out of that, it's really not much. You're just basically transferring dollars from taxpayers to a select group of farmers.
Beth, what do you think?
You know, I wouldn't want to claim that I'm an expert like Professor Babcock there about the farm bill, but I would like to call attention to the research parts of it and actually the farm sort of tools that the USDA and others create to help farmers know about market prices and how much is being grown of certain things.
So you think that we are going to get something. We're going to pick that up.
I would say that that's very focused, again, on those same sort of agribusiness commodity crops.
Kate, can you hold that thought? We're going to take a quick hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Bruce Babcock, professor of economics, Iowa State. Beth Hoffman, managing editor, Food Plus Tech Connect. And you, the phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back out there. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the 2012 Farm Bill coming our way like a freight train down the tracks. Going to take about $100 billion out of our pocket and redistribute it to others in the world, many of whom are people who are receiving food stamps. So we set that aside. Won't argue about that today. But we'll look at the, $30 billion or so that is being distributed to agriculture, and much of that money is going to some of the largest, most successful farmers and landholders in the United States. So we're asking, what on earth are we going to get for our money, our farm bill bucks? And with us today to discuss this question, we have Bruce Babcock, professor of economics, Iowa State University, and Beth Hoffman, managing editor, Food Plus Tech Connect. And Beth, we interrupted your train of thought there with the commercial break, so we'll let you finish here.
Thank you. No, what I was saying is that the money that's allocated for research, and these are sort of, you know, things that people don't think about initially when you think about the Farm Bill, but the kinds of money that's allocated for research and data collection, everything that the USDA and others are keeping their focus on, a lot of that is very heavy, again, on the agribusiness side. You can find out lots of information about, you know, exactly how much corn is being grown in this country. You can find out up to the second, I believe, livestock numbers, you know, how much cattle is selling for. But it's much, much harder when you're trying to figure out how much is planted in organic crops, let's say, or how much the organic or local food industries are growing. There's much less information available, and that's all money that's coming out of the Farm Bill as well.
Okay, that's a good point. Well, let's go kind of back to basics on this, and I'd like to ask both of you why on earth we have a Farm Bill in the first place. Every 5 years, the government writes a new Farm Bill. First of all, what is the Farm Bill, Bruce?
Well, the Farm Bill is a big piece of legislation that basically sets the regulations and the policies that we have in place to govern agriculture, broadly defined. So they have so-called different titles in the or parts of the Farm Bill that cover commodity subsidies, conservation programs, trade programs, nutrition programs, credit, rural development, research, forestry. So it, a wide variety, including crop insurance, regulation of commodity futures. So it's a all-encompassing piece of legislation that is written typically every 5 years to update it and reconfigure how we're regulating and subsidizing all of those parts of agriculture.
Have you ever read one, a farm bill, just out of curiosity?
I've read parts of it, for sure,
okay.
Because and people read the parts that affect them, and so the Farm Bill is what governs the policies of the United States.
The law of the land. Yeah. Beth, did you, when you had your Farm Bill hackathon, did you actually take a big Farm Bill and look at it and read it?
I have read, sections,
parts
again,
of it.
Just like Bruce is saying, but no, I have not read the 680-whatever pages it is, no.
I imagine it would be fun reading. Why every 5 years, Bruce?
Tradition, number one. But number two is that they try to put in place the programs so that a lot of the programs in the Farm Bill are what are called mandatory spending. That's a technical term. It just means that people are entitled to the payments that are in the program. And so every 5 years they look at what they've put in place for mandatory spending, and it's a good idea not to just put these things on autopilot. Another reason is that there's something called the 1949 law that governs how commodities are subsidized. And so that's like a big sword of Damocles hanging over the United States government, that if we don't pass a farm bill every 5 years, we revert back to that so-called permanent law, and then the subsidies would go through the roof because it would be tracked for inflation since 1949. So that permanent law is basically forces Congress to rewrite farm bills every 5 years.
How is the farm bill written? I mean, Congress people generally don't know enough about all this stuff to write the bill itself, so they must get help from staff and probably from industry as well.
As any piece of legislation at the federal government, it's written by staff that are informed by lobbyists. And so the people that have a stake in the Farm Bill are the ones that have the most interest in seeing that the Farm Bill's written to benefit them. And so they make sure that they're in there informing the staff what it is they want in the Farm Bill. And informing, they call it educating, but it's educating with their point of view.
Sure.
And so that's how, and so then the staff write it up, and the politics take place, and so they have to get enough votes to get out of the agricultural committees, and then in a conference report. It was interesting this year they tried to bypass everything and just go straight to the super committee with a farm bill, and it was going to bypass all the committee structures, all the floor votes, all amendments, and so they were really writing a farm bill largely in secret this year because they didn't think they had the votes to get the subsidies passed that they wanted. So it was real interesting. But lucky for people who want farm bill reform, the super committee actually failed.
And thus, there at this time is no farm bill, and so it's open for discussion. And Beth, do you know, has the alternative agriculture been in there being a squeaky wheel like the rest of industry?
I would say, I mean, I think also, though, is it true, Bruce, that then it's the farm bill that we had is the one that exists until we get a new one, correct?
That's right. We have a farm bill. What they were trying to do is pass the next farm bill through the super committee. But we don't have to write a new farm bill till next year, 2012. So the 2008 farm bill still governs what we have right now.
And if we
And
if we don't pass a 2012 Farm Bill, we revert to 1949 law that says we must make changes with respect to inflation. So the subsidies would be indexed to inflation from 1949, and thus, you know, a pound of cotton would be probably worth $7 million.
Not quite that bad, but you get that. That is, yes, in general, okay. Right.
So there is a significant inducement to write. Go ahead, Beth.
Oh, I was just going to answer your question about alternative. Were people upset about the super committee situation, I think was your question, and trying to have their voice heard. And certainly that was true. I mean, I think the media all over was not very pleased with the process. And I think even for a lot of the different farm bureaus, and it sort of was a anti-democracy sort of process at work. And I think it made lots of different groups uncomfortable, so there were perhaps some strange bedfellows, but yes, I think that there was a lot of discussion about what was going on, a lot of speculation, and I think, you know, even to this point, nobody knows exactly what was proposed by the Agricultural Committee, if I understand that correctly, and if that's going to stand now as sort of the template for what's going to go on in the next year or so.
Good question. Bruce, do we know what they tried to sneak through the super committee?
We only have hints, and the hints that we saw were really a reversal of the what I would call the liberalization of the farming sector, which means to try to get farmers to respond to market prices rather than government prices. The hints that we got were that a lot of reversal was going to take place. They were going to raise the support prices for the major commodities, corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, rice. They were going to tack on.
They were going to get as much of our money as they possibly could, but the time ran out, and ours did too. Going to go to a quick break, right back on the Farm Bill. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, as taxpayers rendered bankrupt beyond belief by a government that promises to give everybody everything for nothing and has, you and I just have to ask, what will we get for the $100 billion of Farm Bill legislation that's coming down the track from the 2012 Farm Bill? What is it that will it make our food chain any more safe? Will there be more food? What do you think? That's the question on the table today, and we've got a couple of very smart people who are helping us out finding an answer. We have Beth Hoffman, who's a managing editor of Food Plus Tech Connect, an organization that just helped, I guess what you hosted, a Farm Bill hackathon. Is that what you did?
We hosted a Farm Bill hackathon, and we also just bring news about information and technology to people throughout the food chain.
And then you can look that up by Googling Food Plus Tech Connect. And also with us today, we have Bruce Babcock, who's a professor of economics, Iowa State University. Bruce, I'd like to start with you. In looking at some of the papers you've worked on, you focusing intently on the impact of a lot of this government money on subsidies and insurance, I guess. So the paper that you wrote with somebody, it was called, it was focusing on insurance. Tell us a little bit about that. The revenue insurance boondoggle, a taxpayer-paid windfall for industry. I like boondoggles. There's a lot of them going around these days.
Yeah, and right now the main source of subsidies to farms is something called direct payments. And direct payments are $5 billion a year that go to farmers regardless of what the price is, regardless of how much they produce, regardless of even if they plant a crop. It's just fixed payments. And so those, in an era when we're have a huge federal budget deficit, it's very hard to defend $5 billion going to farmers that are having record farm income.
Well, wait a minute. Now, why did we start doing that in the first place? Why did we start handing out farmers checks and saying, here, we love you, take all the money?
Because in the past, what we did, we would give a high guaranteed price to farmers and say, if you produce this crop, you get this, you get a big check if you're by responding to the government price. Well, farmers tended to overproduce those crops that were subsidized, and our trading partners didn't like that because that overproduction ended up in export markets, and world prices fell. So we were depressing world prices by that kind of policy. So instead, if you just give a farmer a check, regardless of how much they produce, then they're not going to they won't respond to the government price. They'll respond to the market price, so they won't overproduce relative to what the market wants. So in 1996, we adopted these direct payments to get farmers away from farming the government programs and farming for the market. And it was wildly successful. But it's hard to defend giving those checks to farmers. But so what has going on now is that they're reversing themselves to a certain extent, and they're trying to start giving subsidies in the form of insurance. Because who could be against insurance? You know, if a drought or a flood or hail or wind or fire damage your crop, there's more recognition that payments that go to farmers when they have production problems might be more palatable to the general public. And so what they're doing now is moving away from the kinds of payments that don't influence farmers' decisions to the kind of payments that do influence farmers' decisions, which are these insurance. And so what I really wanted to do is look at those kinds of insurance programs and say, is it really a good move? Are we really getting more bang for our buck out of insurance than out of these direct payments?
So would we be making a transition then from direct payments to insurance, or are we going to give them both?
It looks like we're going to make the transition from direct payments to insurance. And the problem with that is that we already are spending about $8 billion a year of taxpayer monies on a huge insurance program for farmers that they already have. So what it looks like we're going to do is pile insurance on top of insurance. And one of them, farmers pay a small portion of premium, and on another one, they won't pay any portion of the premium. So it's really becoming a bit hard to defend the insurance route. In addition,
well, Beth Hoffman, as a journalist and as somebody who looks at agriculture and tries to help things down the road, and you see a situation like this, what do you think?
I think it's it's quite a hard thing to assess, because I think there are so many, the word insurance, like Bruce is saying, obviously people feel like that's probably a good thing and you're getting compensated for something that, you tried and it failed. But it's really hard to read between the lines to understand. I mean, it took a professor as experienced in this as Professor Babcock, it took a whole separate study to understand actually what the implications of that might be. And so, in my opinion, that makes it very difficult for the public to actually understand what might be the ramifications of these things.
Do you think that's how things like crop subsidies end up getting log jammed into legislation so that nobody can untangle them and get them out? It's just they're so confusing that nobody can understand them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think.
Well, that's an unequivocal yes for Bruce. Beth, what do you think?
I think it's difficult. I mean, I have a family. My in-laws are Iowa corn soy farmers.
So we're close here, aren't we?
Subsidies. Yes, there's a full circle. I think that for them, it's been that, these things have evolved and that you start growing certain crops that are supported. And it's sort of, on that level, sort of just evolves. And I think it's it's sort of difficult to know for kind of the family farm, and that's who you see people like the Farmer Alliance and groups like that sort of bringing out to say, we're the small family farm and we're being supported by these same subsidies, but who's actually receiving the bulk of them is a different story altogether.
Well, Bruce, let me ask you this. How does giving farmers money impact the marketplace for farmers? I'm going to have to take a quick break, but I'd like to know, because this is one of the things in farm country you always hear. You see somebody that's really big, and people will say, well, he's been farming the government for a long time, and that's why he's big, and that's why nobody else can compete with him. Is there any validity in the notion that government's largesse is really fouling up the competition for producing food for us? That's the question I guess I'd like to ask. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the 2012 Farm Bill, $100 billion of our money. That's you and I. And we're so bankrupt we can't even see straight. So what are we going to get for our bucks? Do stay tuned. We will be right back. And you can call also if you'd like. We'd love to hear from you. We're at 831-479-1080. 831-479-1080. We do have callers on the line. So away we go when we get back. Do stay tuned. $100 billion. That's what the government's going to take out of our pocket to juice the nation's food chain on the 2012 Farm Bill. So the question on the table, what will we get for our billions of Farm Bill bucks? And that's what we're playing with today. Beth Hoffman, Managing Editor, Food and Tech Connect, and also Bruce Babcock, Professor of Economics, Iowa State University. Bruce, I left off with a question. What impact does all of this government money have on the competition to grow food for you and I?
Well, it depends critically on how that money is given out. If farmers have to produce certain crops in order to get the money, then they're more likely to grow those certain crops. And when we say certain crops, the money from the Farm Bill is targeted on the big field crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, rice, grain sorghum, oats, the big field crops. The crops that aren't subsidized, everything else, tree, nuts, fruit, vegetables, livestock.
All the things that are good for us to eat, right?
Well, that's right. Livestock production, largely, except for the dairy sector, is unsubsidized. So if the, like we mentioned earlier, if the government just writes the checks to farmers that qualify for the payments, and the farmers don't have to produce a certain mix of crops, then the mix of production is largely unaffected by the checks flowing into their bank account.
Mm-hmm.
But if the as was proposed, looked like proposed in the for the 2012 Farm Bill, that farmers are going to start looking more to the government about what to farm, I think that it has the potential for incentivizing the production of corn, soybeans, wheat, something that we've largely not done since 1996 to a large extent. So it really depends on how we write those checks to farmers.
Okay, we're going to go to phones right now. The phone number today, 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. Greg, welcome to The Food Chain.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a former KGO listener, and now I'm your listener. So
welcome aboard.
Success to you, yes. My question is, I mean, I probably know only about this because I watched the documentary Food, Inc.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just so it made me wonder, is there some way we can make sure that this money doesn't go to the large corporations like Monsanto and stays with the family farmers? And is there something that can be done to allow family farmers to still recycle their seeds and not be sued if they do?
Well, let's separate those questions and go with the first question. It always seems to me that the money always most of the money always goes to the biggest farmers. Beth, you have a comment on that?
I think one of the interesting things that came out of the Agriculture Committee's recommendations to the Super Committee a few months ago is that there was a provision that no longer would millionaires be able to receive subsidy payments, mm-hmm. and they capped it at $950,000 for your farm. Actually, if you were married, the two of you could actually be making, each be making that. So, I mean, it's we need to have realistic caps on actually who gets to collect it and what at what point your subsidy payment actually stops. $950,000 is kind of ridiculous. Farms don't, you know, normal family farms, quote unquote, are not making that money.
Well, Bruce and Beth has a great point. And yet it seems like with every farm bill, they try to do the same thing. Millionaires and billionaires can't get all this government money, but it always seems to end up with them anyway.
Well, it you got to remember that, Beth's in-laws, almost all the land in United States is farmed by family farmers. And so there's big family farmers and right. small family farmers. And so, but almost all the land is family farms. And so, you know, the Congress that passes the Farm Bill is not real interested in cutting off the flow of money to farms, farmers, because most of the crops that are subsidized are grown by large farms. It's just a reality. So it's been largely ineffective to try to target small family farms. And, you know, like any government programs, if you only allow smaller farms qualify for payments, what will happen is the big farms will just redefine themselves into a bunch of small farms and still get the payment. So it's really hard to try to reduce the concentration of payments on larger farms.
Okay, and Greg was also wanted to bring up the thing about seeds and whether there is something in the Farm Bill that could be written that would allow farmers to save their seeds. That's kind of a tricky question. Does anybody want to try to tackle that, Beth?
No, I don't want to.
Bruce, you want to try that?
I'll just have one quick comment. You know, farmers can save their seed. The soybeans, if they buy the kind of seed that isn't protected by intellectual property protection. And so farmers are free not to sign a contract with Monsanto or any other big seed company that says that they won't save their seed. That's the contract that they sign. So, you know, farmers are free to do it, to not sign those contracts if they can find some seed that isn't protected by intellectual property.
Right? There you go. Greg, thank you for the call.
Well, thank you.
You bet. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Joanne. Joanne, are you there? Hello? Joanne? Joanne's not there. Maybe I pressed the wrong button. Nope, maybe not. Well, goodbye, Joanne. And let's try going to a break, right? We're going to go to a break? Okay, Nikki says, break time, idiot. So, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We have Bruce Babcock, professor of economics, Iowa State University, Beth Hoffman, managing editor, Food and Tech Connect, and you. The phone number is today, 831-479-1080, 479-1080. We're talking about the 2012 Farm Bill and what on earth the government intends to do with $100 billion of our money. What do you think it should do? 831-479-1080, right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, then the question begins, what kind of farm bill would we like to have? The farm bills that we have had have seemed to develop a food chain heavily dependent on a few basic crops. Is there a way of refocusing that farm bill money so that we have a more realistic diet, or should we just go on the way we have been? Bruce Babcock is a professor of economics. What would you like to see happen?
Well, in an ideal world, what we would do with that money is pay for the things that have a very high rate of return. And the things that have a high rate of return investment are things that are research and development in making sure that we can produce a safe and stable food supply. And so what I would like to see is more research on livestock food production, on the ability to increase crop yields and to produce food and crops in a way that doesn't harm the environment. And so Those are the kind of things that will have a high return on dollars.
So we'll get something for our money. Beth, what do you think? What would you like to see?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that you sort of put aside on this in this discussion for good reason is the SNAP program and other nutritional programs. And I think those are on the table for cuts. They will be cut most likely in this next round. And those showed also to be very high returns per dollar in the communities that they serve. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, research. Definitely, in my mind, also for much more sustainable systems would help promote those systems. Right now, most of those farmers are just on their own in terms of extension and real research. And then thirdly, the conservation component, which we haven't really talked about, is that the money that has gone into conservation has been very successful in helping helping agricultural practices that are more environmentally friendly and putting aside land for conservation, and those are too going to be cut in the next round. So to me, that's a better use of our money as well.
Okay, and Joanne, what would you like to see in the Farm Bill?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that this reminds me a lot about how we subsidize the auto industry, but they had to pay back the money once they made it. So I'm real curious how this works and really how much money these big farmers are making on the backs of American taxpayers. The question that I have is, what percentage of the food that these commodity big farm growers raise actually feeds Americans, and what percentage is actually exported to other populations, other countries? And
and holy smokes, what a question. Well, Bruce, is there any way of tracking that? Is there any way of tracking that we're getting what we're paying for? Thank you, Joanne.
Sure. The USDA keeps track of how much we export and how much we import. And we do export more food than we import. We run a trade surplus in food and agricultural products. But most of what we produce is consumed at home. So, for example, we have a 14 billion bushel corn crop about. We export about 2 billion of those bushels of corn.
And then we're out of money, we're out of time, but we're not out of fun. Thank you so much, Bruce Babcock, professor of economics, Iowa State University, Beth Hoffman, managing editor, Food Plus Tech Connect, and thank you all out there. Remember, cheap food isn't, and join us on the forums at metrofarm.com.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.
CNN Radio. I'm Barbara Hall. The Senate has given final approval to a spending bill that will keep the government operating through September. It also voted to extend the payroll tax cut, but just for 2 months. President Obama says the extra money average Americans will get in their paychecks will make a real difference.
Today I'm glad that both parties in Congress came together, and I want to thank them for ensuring that as we head into the holidays, folks at home don't have to worry about their taxes going up.
The House is expected to vote on the two-month extension Monday. The president says the payroll tax cut should be extended through next year. He says not doing so would be inexcusable. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta is in Libya. He's meeting with officials of the transitional government that took over after Muammar Gaddafi was ousted from power. Panetta says he's confident Libya's new leaders will achieve a successful transition to democracy. A pretrial hearing continues today for Army Private Bradley Manning. He's accused of providing hundreds of thousands of secret documents to WikiLeaks. Yesterday, the presiding judge rejected a motion by defense lawyers challenging his impartiality. Manning's lawyers are appealing that decision to the Army Court of Criminal Appeals. The death of Florida A&M drum major Robert Champion Jr. has been ruled a homicide. Hazing is the official cause of death. Dr. Jorge Rodriguez says Champion died of blunt force trauma.
The bruising was so intense and the beating was so savage that he bled into his muscles, and that caused his heart to stop.
So far, no one has been charged. In the Philippines, more than 400 people have been killed by a tropical storm. Another 150 are missing. The country's Red Cross chairman, Richard Gordon, fears the Philippine government is not likely to handle this one very well.
I don't think the government has the political will, and none of our governments have had the political will to address these problems.
This is CNN Radio.
At some stores, holiday shopping is hard.
Hi, I'm looking for holiday gifts, and I need a poor selection of tech products.
You've come to the right place. Our selection is pathetic.
Oh, and the prices on your tablets and laptops are...
astronomical.
Perfect.
But at Staples, it's easy to find great prices on e-readers this holiday season. Come in and try the color touchscreen and cloud-accelerated web browser of Kindle Fire, or experience the new Nook tablet with the benefits of Nook Color, plus the best in HD entertainment. Staples, that was easy.
GEICO makes it so simple to save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. But why stop there? GEICO finds every possible way to save you even more money. Good driver discounts, multi-car discounts, even good student discounts. And don't forget our Looking Fine discount, a discount for the attractive folk like yourselves. Okay, there's not really a Looking Fine discount, just seeing if you're paying attention. It's not a bad idea, though.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com to see how much you could save. GEICO, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Good morning, everyone. You're tuned in to KSTO 1080. I'm Nikki James. Got your forecast here. We got some sunny skies today. High of about 65 and light winds. Tonight's going to be mostly clear. Low of 39 with light winds. And tomorrow, sunny skies, high of 61. South-southwest winds, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Out on the Monterey Bay, the east winds, 5 to 15 knots. Becoming south this afternoon, the wind waves are going to be about 3 feet late in the morning, becoming less than 2, with a west swell of 3 to 5 feet at 16 seconds. Tonight, southwest winds to 10 knots, becoming east after midnight. The wind waves are going to be less than 2 feet, a west swell of 3 to 5 feet at 16 seconds. And tomorrow out there, the northeast winds, 5 knots, becoming west in the afternoon. Wind waves will be less than 2 feet and a west swell of 5 to 7 feet at 15 seconds. Got some current temperatures for you here. We got Watsonville at 44 degrees and clear skies. Clear in Monterey at 53 degrees. And in Salinas, we got a little bit of a haze going on, and it's 46 degrees. We're at 50 degrees here in Santa Cruz, right outside KSCO Studios. For your King of the Hill traffic update, let's see what I can report on here. We just had a traffic collision reported a few minutes ago on northbound 101, just south of, looks like just south of 9, Hollister-Gilroy area. It looks like a two-car crash there, and they're in the center divide. Other than that, nothing much going on. So if you see something out there, that you can call me at 475-1080. Let me know what you see, and the official time is 10:05 and 10 seconds on this Saturday, December 17th. Up next, we've got this Saturday special with MZ. Stay tuned. KSCO Santa Cruz, I'm Nikki James.
You sure are, aren't you, Nikki?
Yay!
May I ask you a personal... No, forget. We'll suspend
personal.
The personal questions for today.
Oh, is it because it's the holidays?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Give me a break.
That's the reason why. So are you having a good time today?
I am having a great time.
Well, good. Have you been? it's been a wild and woolly week here at KSU.
I've heard.
Yeah. Oh, so you've heard, but have you heard any of it yourself?
No, not really.
Well, we got so many requests for the epic radio that took place here on Thursday, during the Dr. Corey Gold Show, where I was the guest, the 10th.